revising their notes during the evenings. Over the past 18 hours, they have finalized their summaries, aiming to synthesize the vast amount of data and other information into a clear and concise snapshot of the key knowledge that has been generated this week. No easy task. We will begin with the reports from each of the five scientific tracks. We will then hear from the rapporteurs of the youth, community, and leadership programs. The rapporteur reports, the text versions of the reports, will be posted on the conference website shortly after the end of this conference. The plenary presenters, for the first time in the history of the conference, have selected co-authors and together written manuscripts that will be published in the Journal of the International AIDS Society in partnership with Biomed Central later this year. In addition, for the first time in the history of the conference, we are preparing an impact report with multiple components, and a whole team of writers, additional writers, have been working with the rapporteur teams this week. That impact report will be available in October. And for the first time in the history of the conference, all of the sessions have been taped and videoed and will be made available through the conference website later on this year. In addition, again a first for the conference, there are over 100 partner hubs throughout the world, places where groups of people have been gathering this week and will be gathering post-conference to review and discuss sessions that are of most relevance to that particular location. And finally, all of the abstracts for this conference and every other one dating back to 2001 can be searched now on the IAS website, www.iasociety.org. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you our first rapporteur, Guido Silvestri, reporting on Track A, Biology and Pathogenesis of HIV.
Thank you, Craig. Good morning. Buenos dias, and also buongiorno for the few Italians in the room. It's a great honor to have been chosen to summarize the advances in basic science that have come out of this conference. And it's also a difficult task and a challenge because there have been so many important pieces of work that have been presented. And in selecting a few themes and a few contributions, you always leave out a lot of very, very good presentations and contributions. So what I'm going to do in these 15 minutes is discussing four themes of basic science that I believe have been the hotspots for science at this conference. And for each of these themes, I will discuss a few specific contributions. So these are the major themes in basic HIV/AIDS research that I believe emerge from this conference. There was a lot of work on the determinants of HIV transmission, and needless to say, this is something very important in terms of our efforts to generate effective preventative strategies, particularly microbicides and vaccines. There's also much progress in terms of cell restriction and genetic factors, as we're understanding more and more the interaction between the virus and the host cell. And this is very important because any elucidation of this interaction may lead to the identification of targets for therapy, antiretroviral therapy. And particularly, if we can at some point target cellular genes, then we will have therapeutic targets that are not going to be able to escape. The third area is AIDS vaccine research, and I've been trying to find some good news in the field. You all know that this area is a bit in sort of revisiting a lot of concepts after the failure of the STEP trial and the cancellation of the PAVE 100 trial. And finally, I will discuss the important issue of how we better appreciate the complexity of the interaction between the virus and the host immune system, particularly in the sense of somehow revisiting the old immunological paradigm of HIV infection, that the immune system, the immune responses against the virus are always good, and in reality, they also could be sometimes, in some circumstances, part of the problem. So in terms of HIV transmission, I selected three contributions. The first is by Eric Hunter. Eric is a professor at Emory University. In previous work, Eric described an extreme genetic bottleneck observed during HIV transmission. In more recent work that was presented at this conference, Eric showed that this genetic bottleneck is much less severe when the transmission doesn't occur between monogamous partners, but between more promiscuous partners. And he highlighted the possible role of sexual transmitted infections and mucosal inflammation in favoring this less genetically constrained type of infection. And this work has a lot of implications in terms of vaccines and microbicides. There also was very interesting work by Dr. Victor Garcia at University of Texas Southwestern and Dr. Kish Catalone at DeSales University in Pennsylvania. They brought up new animal models, particularly humanized mice. And these animals can be particularly useful in testing concepts relative to HIV transmission and the use of microbicides. And I thought it was particularly intriguing the Kish Cataloni model of humanized cervico-vaginal tissue in mice. The third contribution in this area was by Dr. Christos Petropoulos of Monogram. And he provided very good characterization of the transmission of CXCR4 tropic viruses. And I thought this is an important concept because even though it's only a minority of viruses, transmitted viruses that are CXCR4 tropic, I think the field should start thinking of whether or not this is going to become a problem if CCR5 based microbicides are used at some point as sort of carpet microbicide treatment in developing countries. The second theme is the cell restriction and genetic factors. There was a very, very nice review by Dr. Mario Stevenson of University of Massachusetts. He summarized what we know, what we have learned in the past few years in terms of host restriction factors. And he discussed particularly the discovery of tethering or CD317 as the cellular factor that tethered the virus and counteracts virus virions release and whose action is counteracted by the viral protein VPU. A very nice presentation by Dr. Jing highlighted the complexity of the molecular interaction between HIV and the host cells. He used siRNA library to identify cellular genes that restrict HIV replication in Jurkat cells. And again, here the objective down the road is to identify targets for therapy. And as I said before, if these targets are cellular targets, that will mean that there will not be escape, and that could be a potential major advance in terms of treatment. Finally, I wanted to emphasize a very elegant model by Dr. Perez in the laboratory of Tom Hope in Chicago. They used double fluorescent viruses where the core of the virus is labeled with GFP and the membrane is labeled with the S15 cherry red dye. And these double fluorescent viruses are very, very good to study virus encoding. And virus encoding is going to be important in terms of potential antiviral action of specific compounds targeting this process, but also in terms of understanding the processing of the interaction between dendritic cells and T cells and how virus that are picked up by dendritic cells are presented to T cells, because the encoding is a key process in this interaction. So I was really trying to find some good news on the HIV vaccine front. You all know that the field in a state of soul searching after the STEP trial, the results of the STEP trial that were published in September 2007. So I singled out a contribution by Dr. Boyer and Weiner at the University of Pennsylvania. They were able to improve the immunogenicity, significantly improve the immunogenicity of DNA. There used to be a popular platform for AIDS vaccine a few years ago and then sort of got out of fashion. And they were able to improve the immunogenicity of these vaccines by use electroporation and by adding adjuvants, particularly cytokines or chemokines. I think that our effort to make an AIDS vaccine will not materialize until we better understand the interaction of the virus and the host immune system, and particularly the correlates of immune protection from infection and disease progression. In this regard, I thought that a very good talk was presented by Dr. Streck in Marcus Hauptfeld Lab at the Partners for AIDS Research at Harvard University in Boston. They describe some specificities of CD8 T-cell responses that emerge during primary HIV infection and are correlated with better control of virus replication during the chronic infection. I also thought that it's still important to keep studying the elite controllers, those lucky HIV-infected individuals that, despite not being treated with any antiretroviral drugs, spontaneously control virus replication and remain healthy. And the main problem is understanding what is behind, what determines this phenotype. And there are three main possibilities. The one is that the virus is intrinsically less fit, that there are cell restriction factors that block virus replication at a single cell level, or is that there is a host immune system type of control on virus replication. There were two very nice presentations by Dr. Eric Hartz from Case Western University in Cleveland and Dr. Miura also at the Partners for AIDS Research, highlighting the fact that when you look at virus fitness in virus isolated from long-term non-progressor or elite controllers and you use state-of-the-art virological techniques, then you can often find evidence for a reduced fitness, intrinsic fitness of these viruses, both at the level of GAG and at the level of the envelope protein. I now move to the next and last area that I would like to highlight, and it's the appreciation of the complexity of the interaction between HIV and the host immune system. Again, as I mentioned before, I don't think we will have an AIDS vaccine until we fully understand the interaction, this interaction, and particularly the fact that this interaction is complicated, that HIV is a virus that replicates preferentially on activated CD4 T cells. And pretty much every time an immune response is elicited by virtue or a prophylactic or a therapeutic vaccine, there is an intrinsic risk of generating activated CD4 T cells and therefore fuel virus replication. There was very nice work by Andrea Lisco in the laboratory of Dr. Leonid Margolis at the NIH, looking at the pathogenic role of chronic immune activation in favoring HIV disease progression. Andrea and Lonia are using a very interesting model of in vitro lymphoid tissue that allows us to study the interaction between the virus and the host immune system and also determine what are the effects of the immune activation, not only on the infected cells, but also on the bystander uninfected cells. There was a very nice presentation by Tedra Goffin in the laboratory of Christiana Petri from Tulane University, describing a nice study of CD20 depletion in African green monkeys. Now, the important thing is that African green monkeys and Sudimangabis are natural hosts for HIV infection and don't progress to AIDS despite high level of virus replication. And they appear to do so actually not because of a better control of the virus, but because of attenuated responses to the virus. And what Dr. Goffin and Apetri showed in their presentation is that the depletion of CD20 cells is not associated with major changes in virus replication in this animal, again suggesting that their lack of disease progression is not related to a particularly strong or effective immune response. And as you may imagine, this work has a lot of implications in terms of AIDS vaccine development. There was a very interesting session on the role of co-pathogens, and I thought the highlight of that session was a presentation by Dr. Jake Stapleton from Iowa University, presenting the role of GBVC, hepatotropic virus, non-pathogenic, that has this very strange role in somehow protecting from HIV disease progression in co-infected individuals. And Dr. Stapleton is making a lot of progress in understanding the mechanism underlying this action of GBVC. And I believe that this could have a profound implication in terms of therapy for HIV infection. Finally, there were there were two talks on the concept on the concept of the exhaustion of the T cell specific immune responses as a factor of progression, disease progression during HIV infection. The first of this molecule is PD-1 that is expressed on T cells activated that eventually become exhausted in presence of chronic virus replication. There was a nice presentation by Dr. Joseph Conrad from Vanderbilt University indicating that the expression of PD-1 is more pronounced in dominant versus subdominant clonotypes of HIV-specific CD8-positive T cells. There was also a very nice presentation by Dr. Marilyn Addo, also from the Partners of AIDS Research, Harvard University in Boston, highlighting the role of a new molecule, TIM-3, who also appears to be a marker of exhaustion of T-cell responses during HIV infection. So I want to finish here by thanking the five individuals that made this possible, Dr. Mirko Paiordini and Barbara Cervasi on the left, and then moving towards the right, Dr. Lisa Chakrabarty from Pasteur Institute, Dr. Jean Boyer from University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Lonia Margolis from the NIH. I couldn't have done this without their help. And finally, I want to thank Janelle, Avril, Emily Blitz, and Krista Newhouse from the staff that really provided tremendous support for us, and all the volunteers at the rapporteur office. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Can I just note that Guido Silvestri is an associate professor of pathology, microbiology, and immunology at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, U.S. Thank you. I'd like to introduce now the second rapporteur. Marco Victoria from Brazil is a medical officer of the HIV/AIDS department at the World Health Organization in Geneva. He will be reporting back on Track B, clinical science, treatment, and care.
Good morning. At first, I wish to thank the organizers for having invited me as one of the head reporters of this conference. It was an honor to me and also the World Health Organization to have contributed in this session. Thank you very much for this really enjoyable adventure. Well, then I would like to start with some take-home message extracted by my team from the plenaries, oral sessions, and poster presentations. Point number one, treatment works as long as patients have access and can stay on it. Retention, loss, or follow-up are the two major challenges to reach universal access. Accelerating access to antiretroviral therapy is the most effective way of reducing the early HIV mortality. Task shifting and mentoring are successful strategies to improve access in resource-limited settings. Lack of infrastructure and diagnostics continue to be important barriers to scale up antiretroviral therapy in children. And being simple seems to be the best way to continue to scale up prevention, treatment, and care. And then, an important message is that the unified strategy and HIV prevention must marry treatment with involvement of the community. As I have only 15 minutes to describe the major issues of this important conference track, the following major topics were selected for my brief comments. Number one, treatment outcomes in source-metered settings. Number two, task-shifting experiences. Some information about new drugs. The abacavir controversies that occurred in this meeting. Some information about TB-HIV co-infection. Antiretroviral therapy in children. Early antiretroviral therapy initiation. And immune activation and cardiovascular risk. Regarding antiretroviral outcomes, despite the good global scale-up results, treat outcomes vary considerably between countries and regions, and we can observe in some studies that we are discussing here during this week. The white figure is the first multi-country cohort study that represents data from Latin America and the Caribbean. Among more than 5,000 patients of this cohort, the overall one-year all-cause mortality rate was around 8%, similar to the reported in other lower-income countries. But observe that in the range from 2.4% in Argentina to 12% in Haiti, and the loss of follow-up ranged from 0.6% in Honduras to 17% in Argentina. Those outcomes differences between programs are possibly due to the later presentation and different criteria for antiretroviral therapy eligibility, maturity of the program, and comorbidity conditions. In contrast, in Botswana, the 6-year survival rate was almost 90%, and nearly half of the deaths occurred in the first 3 months. Despite some limitations in this analysis, this is an example that supports that early initiation of antiretroviral therapy improves treatment success, and the political commitment and collaboration of partners enable successful implementation of treatment programs. Another important topic discussed here was the task shifting. During this conference, experience on antiretroviral therapy programs in many countries which have implemented task shifting were presented, usually from physicians to nurses, in the context of acute shortage in human resources. The positive impact of nurses is in care of patients living with HIV is clear, with high levels of patient satisfaction, increased and more rapid initiation of antiretroviral therapy, and outcomes comparable to traditional modes of care. An example of task shifting benefits, this slide showed that evolution of facilities providing antiretroviral therapy in Mozambique and demonstrate that the técnicos de medicina have been important drivers for expanding access to antiretroviral therapy. As you can see, the decisions to train all técnicos de medicina in antiretroviral therapy lead to a tripling of facilities providing antiretroviral therapy over 6 months, bringing antiretroviral therapy to all districts in the country. Note that this does not necessarily lead to a commensurate increase in the number of patients accessing antiretroviral therapy in this country. In another study from Rwanda, the application of task shifting nationwide over the course of the year would result in 78% decrease in the physician demand to just 17 physicians working per 30 days hours week, or just 11% of the total number, the total public physician capacity. The amount of physicians' capacity available for complicated cases of non-HIV care is almost 200% higher with this task shifting. New drugs. Unfortunately, there are few new data about drugs in development presented in this conference. Some posters and oral presentations confirmed the benefits of new antiretrovirus such as haltegravir, which is already in the market, apricitabine and rilpivirine in multi-drug patients, resistant patients. As a curiosity, an elevation in CPK levels were detected in the haltegravir study, highlighting the unforeseen toxicities can become important in the environment of expanding access to antiretroviral therapy. The key message in this topic is that the introduction to the market of these new drugs can impact in the recommended antiretroviral regimens, providing new options in the treatment of multi-drug resistance patients, and also can add more alternatives to first line or even prevention, as suggested by Dr. Coyne during his plenary session at this conference. D4T is still the major antiretroviral therapy in use in resource-limited settings. Despite the current trend to moving from D4T to other nucleoside drugs, histidine-based regimens continue to be the most used therapeutic option in Africa, as we can see in the graphic of the left that showed that the data of first-line antiretroviral therapy use in adults in 250 sites in Africa, covering almost 300,000 patients. The yellow, green, and blue bars are D4T-containing regimens, and in these sites, D4T-containing regimens still comprise more than 70% of first-line antiretroviral therapy. However, on the right are the resistance profiles of 101 patients in Malawi who failed D4T first-line antiretroviral therapy, showing pan-RTI resistance in non-B subtype using D4T in first-line, which is compromised the efficacy of availability of second-line regimens. According to this data, between 22 to 50% of patients have no fully active drugs in the recommended second-line backbone, highlighting the need to reevaluate the definition of clinical and immunologic criteria to change therapy in low-resource settings. An important message of this issue, the paradigm shift of D4T substitution to options with less long-term metabolic toxicity, seems to be one of the biggest challenges and is closely related to a real availability of options, improvement of lab and monitoring structure, and cost neutrality in relation to other alternative drugs in these settings. The Abacavir controversies was an important topic in this track. Regarding Abacavir, some conflicting data regarding its safety and efficacy was discussed in oral sessions and late breakers. Some cohorts are associating this drug with an increased risk of myocardial infarction, and other studies found an increased chance of virological failure when compared with tenofovir, particularly when the patient has a high cardiovascular risk profile or a high viral load, respectively. However, limitations have been found in all these studies, and more adequately designed clinical trials has been suggested to clarify this issue. Furthermore, the relevance of this issue at global level seems to be currently limited, and the availability and use of this drug in developing countries is still very low. TB continues to complicate HIV care and treatment and remains a major problem in people living with HIV, particularly in Africa. However, early heart initiation, improved survival, and evidence-based intervention exist at nationwide scale-up is possible. As a good example of this impact on survival, a study presented by Dr. Saraceni showed that heart initiated after a new TB episode in HIV-positive patients in region and in Brazil reduced the risk of death in 70%. And what about TB prevention? Implementation of cotrimoxazole prophylaxis and isoniazid preventive therapy policies in 69 TB-HIV high-burden countries is still low. However, some examples of countries that are implementing IPT were shown in this conference with reduction of the number of TB cases among those who completed IPT. HIV in children. Regarding HIV in children, the conference showed the national programs are reporting good outcomes. The number of children receiving antiretroviral therapy increased from about 75,000 in 2005 to almost 200,000 in 2007. However, many children living with HIV are still not receiving treatment, and mortality among them remains high. Because of this, WHO established a new recommendation that all infants under 12 months of age with confirmed HIV infection should be started on antiretroviral therapy, irrespective of clinical or immunological stage. However, 18 out of 24 countries in Asia-Pacific region do not have capacity to confirm diagnosis by PCR in young children. Then, when to start? One important discussion occurred during this conference was regarding the when to start therapy, and the treatment pendulum swing up from the aggressive hit and heart early approach in mid-90s to more a conservative before reach 200 approach of recent years because of the toxicity and impossibility to eradicate the virus, the when to start pendulum swing back to earlier initiation of heart. The current trend identified in this conference suggests that the threshold is moving to 350 cells per ml or even higher in some situations, according to some developed country guidelines. This has been largely driven by the availability of drugs with a better toxicity profile, a new understanding of the impact of HIV-driven inflammatory process on apparently well people, and the emerging concept of serious non-AIDS events. However, unforeseen antiretroviral toxicities remain important in the environment of lifelong therapy. Furthermore, starting earlier will have a significant impact on antiretroviral therapy scale-up, goals for antiretroviral coverage, human resources, and cost. This discussion should consider not only the clinical aspects, but also other decision domains. As it was said by Greg Gonsalves in a plenary session during this meeting, the adoption of recommendation without considering the context where it will be applied can bring more harm than good. Immune activation and cardiovascular risk. This very interesting presentation showing that virus, host, and also drugs are involved in the immune activation and its potential involvement in the development of atherosclerosis and cardiovascular events. Some antiretroviral drugs can alter several parameters such as lipids, insulin resistance, and inflammation, showing that development of cardiovascular events can be multifactorial, warranting the need of exploring inflammatory markers, genetics, metabolic patterns, and antiretroviral drug profiles in the genes of atherosclerosis in HIV patients. We need to understand better this phenomenon in order to design clinical interventions translatable to the general practice. And what is the future of scale-up? Here, I would like to remind some messages from yesterday's Greg Gonsalves talk. The scale-up of AIDS treatment is the most ambitious public health undertaking of our lifetimes. It is the first attempt to treat a chronic disease among millions of poor people in the developing world. Another point, the future success of antiretroviral scale-up depends on the strengthening primary care worldwide. And finally, the struggle of AIDS treatment can be a catalyst for strengthening health systems in low and middle-income countries. Then, what we can expect regarding the issues of this track for the next conference? Universal Access Report certainly will be an important point, with discussions on achievements and way forward. More on antiretroviral therapy, non-invasive, non-AIDS events, and inflammatory markers. Point of care for diagnosis and antiretroviral monitoring. More on operational research, maybe the science of the future. More on pill once daily options. More conclusive data on tenofovir safety profile in specific populations. More conclusive studies on abacavir safety and efficacy. Role of new classes in initiation therapy and RT failure management, with a possibility to start to discuss about nucleoside sparing regimens. And the when to start debate that probably will continue to there. I also like to remind some issues like the HIV in cancer, HIV hepatitis B and C co-infection, and the management of TB in second-line antiretroviral therapy patients that can be relevant in issue in 2010 meeting. Finally, I would like to express my deep gratitude to my colleagues, Chris Duncan, Francois Venter, Omar Suet, Polly Clyden, and Valeria Saraceni, for the dedication and inestimable support to this huge task of review and evaluate almost 1,000 presentations, abstracts, and posters related to this track, prepare session reports, and help me with this presentation in only 4 days. Without you guys, this mission would be impossible. I also would like to thank Simon Collins, Ruben Garnish, and other colleagues that also contributed to this report. Thank you all for the attention, and thanks Mexico for the hospitality.
Thank you, Marco. I'd like to introduce now our Track C reporter, Epidemiology and Prevention, Patrick Sullivan from the United States. Patrick is an HIV epidemiologist and an associate professor of epidemiology at the Rollins School of Public Health of Emory University in Atlanta.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Track C Organizing Committee and the IIS for this chance to share the report of our Track C rapporteur team. And they are pictured here. And I also need to thank them During the week, they posted over 36 summary reports as well as daily reports and spent many thoughtful hours in figuring out where to go with this presentation. Like others, rather than try to give you a comprehensive view of these topics, we've chosen to focus on what we think is new and organize that around some themes for the conference. We'll start with new EPI findings in MSM, and our headline here is Increasing Risk and Incidence and MSM in Challenging or Hostile Environments. Data from the California Counseling and Testing System are shown in the two slides on your right, and they illustrated that from 1997 to 2006, there were increases in self-reported unprotected anal intercourse on the top graph, and on the bottom, during the same period of time, increases in estimated HIV incidence among repeat testers from 2% per year to 2.7% per year. A great presentation talked about sort of a community-based effort in Togo to identify prevention needs for men who had sex with men. Some stakeholders initially weren't in favor of this work because they believed that male-male sex didn't exist in Togo. But this effort both documented the existence of a vibrant MSM community and also highlighted prevention needs. Some of the qualitative work, men who were interviewed said that they didn't believe themselves to be at risk for HIV because they didn't have sex with women. This reminds us that HIV knowledge, which we often take for granted in our HIV prevention efforts, is a critical part of HIV prevention, and that in some populations, in some regions, this is still an issue that we need to address. In an HIV incidence cohort of Thai MSM that is still ongoing, the current estimate of incidence density is 5.1% per year. New EPI findings for heterosexual transmission. And our theme here is drivers of risk in specific populations. You'll hear this again as we move forward. So we want to recognize that there's a high degree of variation in the extent of concurrency in sexual partnerships globally, as depicted in the slide on your right. As you can see, among the countries listed here, there's quite a range of the extent to which men and women report concurrent partnerships. Concurrency is a critical driver of transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. A report from Kristen Dunkel and colleagues indicated that most new HIV infections in two urban African cities come from married and cohabiting partners, 60 to 90% of new infections. This suggests to us that there's a role for the development and implementation of couples-based HIV prevention interventions, such as couples voluntary counseling and testing, which is currently being scaled up in many African countries. Finally, a modeling abstract characterized the risk of transmission for an African woman in Mwanza, and that if she had sex with a 32-year-old man, her risk of being infected with HIV was 19 times greater than if she had sex with a 17-year-old male partner. This points to two issues. One is, what do we mean when we communicate risk, which we'll come back to, and the other is cross-generational sexual partnerships, which was raised as an important issue in many presentations at the conference. We wanted to highlight a little data on co-infection. Dr. Vittoria talked about HIV-TB co-infection, and I'll offer two examples here. And this is important because intersections of infectious diseases offer opportunities for prevention. In the UK, the data are depicted in this graph, HIV-positive MSM were disproportionately affected by other STIs. So although only 7.5% of MSM in UK were infected, they represented 34% of new syphilis cases among MSM and 28% of new gonorrhea cases. In Amsterdam, HCV prevalence among HIV-positive MSM-attending STI clinics was 21% in 2008. Phylogenetic analysis and interviews suggested a role for sexual transmission. We report data from this conference that IDU incidence is dropping in some mature epidemics, but we do so only with the context that we realize that that's not the case everywhere in the world, particularly in Eastern Europe. Data from the U.S. indicate declining HIV incidence after 1990. That's indicated in the pink bar here, so after 1990, the incidence has declined. The estimated incidence of HIV among British Columbia IDUs over the whole period from 1996 to 2004 was 2.7%, but you can see that it dropped over this period of time. And the authors pointed out an ecological correlation between this decreased HIV incidence and decreased community viral load among IDU in the same city.
There were also two reports on HIV prevalence from IDUs that were generated using respondent-driven sampling. Those estimates were from Iran, 25% prevalence, from Tanzania, 26% prevalence. In terms of surveillance, one of the hot topics at the conference was incident surveillance, but we titled this this area, Many Methods, Many Questions. CDC presented new incidence estimates based on STARS methodology that suggested about 56,000 new infections in the U.S. in 2006. And these trends data represent incidence estimation from an enhanced back calculation method, showing a decline, but then relatively stable incidence in all populations except all risk populations except MSM in more recent years. At the same time, a poster from Germany documented that they're putting in place a new incidence surveillance system that's based on the BED assay and really uses more of a probability sample of laboratories as opposed to the state-based approach of CDC. Meanwhile, France reported on an in-house incidence assay, the IDEV3 assay, and they're building on the infrastructure they have of collecting remnant specimens from diagnostic samples. At a WHO pre-meeting, there were efforts to talk about how we reach consensus approaches to measuring incidence so that we can promote a common understanding of what these estimates mean. We'll now move to interventions, and sort of our big picture here is that it's likely we're going to need to combine multiple approaches to reverse the course of the epidemic. On this slide from Jeff Garnett's plenary presentation from Monday, this tipping point, or R0, the basic reproductive number of one, is the finish line we have to cross. And in theory, when we get beyond that in this direction to an R0 of less than one, that will reverse the course of the epidemic. So in this diagram, then, you can have an intervention which reduces risks by 30%, say. And that's good, but it doesn't get us to the finish line. And neither does this hypothetical intervention of reduction in partner numbers by 50%. But when you put these two end-to-end and make a combined intervention, we get much closer to that finish line. So we'll talk some more about prevention packages. There were concerns raised about risk compensation with biomedical interventions, particularly around the circumcision presentations. And although the data from the clinical trials doesn't suggest risk decompensation during the period of their follow-up, we think it's important to reiterate that we'll need to have sustained behavioral interventions as biomedical interventions are developed and scaled up. We also point out that policy really impacts the ability to provide prevention. And we note an abstract where there was differential access to prevention services of MSM based on some policies in their countries. In countries that criminalize male-male sex, only 30% of MSM received needed prevention services. In countries where male-male sex was not criminalized, 60% of MSM received those prevention services. And finally, we recognize gladly the increase in scale-up of ARVs for prevention of mother-to-child transmission. An abstract yesterday reported that the greatest increase in scale-up of PMTCT was in East and Southern Africa, where 90% of the mother-to-child transmissions are estimated to occur. At the same time, we recognize the inequity that there are not adequate treatment resources for the women to protect their own health in the long term. There were several presentations on circumcision. An important one yesterday in the oral abstract session suggests that the protective effects of circumcision are durable to at least 42 months. This was a concern with the earlier trials because of they were stopped early and follow-up was somewhat limited. In this graph, you can see over a period of 42 months, the HIV seroincidence rates in the red line for men who were circumcised and the blue line for uncircumcised controls. Another presentation documented significant protection for men who were circumcised in the Orange Farm trial for HPV prevalence and Trichomonas vaginalis incidence. A modeling exercise sought to identify where we should focus our circumcision resources to obtain maximum long-term impact and suggested that focusing our resources in men less than 34 years old would provide that maximum long-term impact. And finally, barriers to the implementation of circumcision remain. And these are in several broad areas, social, cultural, religious, and as well as has been highlighted this morning, in finding ways to incorporate women into the decision-making process of how circumcision is rolled out. There was a nice summary earlier of vaccines and microbicides, and this is also part of our track. So I'd just like to say that I think as of this conference, these fields are really in a place of rethinking strategies and looking forward to next generation approaches. In vaccines, after the STEP trial results, there are efforts focused back towards vaccine discovery, perhaps new vectors, and better non-human primate models for cell-mediated immunity. There was also a discussion about the role of and the need for neutralizing antibodies in an eventual vaccine strategy. In microbicides, there are ongoing trials with polyanion gels, but I think many in the field are looking forward to the next generation of trials, which will likely be with ARV-based microbicides. We'll talk briefly about some behavioral interventions, and starting with MSM, and our news flash here is promising interventions within limits. So the first abstract that we'll highlight is an e-animation, so an online intervention, to reduce unplanned risk for MSM. And the good news is that intervention worked. But the within limits is that it only worked for men who reported having unplanned risk in the period of time before they had the intervention. This is a graphic from this intervention that tells men they need to prepare themselves before they're confronted with these risks. In an uncontrolled peer-led intervention for HIV positives, this intervention showed promise for reducing risky sex, but again within limits. And in this case, the beneficial effects seemed to be limited to those men who reported having transmission risk at entry. So their reduction in the proportion of sex acts with risk in the 6 months before interview is shown on the top blue line. And on the bottom line is the whole study group. And so the beneficial effects were limited to men who had that pre-existing risk. These little icons for peer-to-peer and interventions for positive will be used in subsequent slides. Interventions for heterosexual transmission that are behavioral, and the theme here is interventions tailored to specific populations. And Gina Wingood and colleagues reported an intervention package for African-American women. This was a package of behavioral, biomedical, and social interventions. And that package reduced STI incidents and number of casual partners among African-American women. A school-based intervention for sixth graders in South Africa reduced unprotected vaginal intercourse and multiple partners at a 12-month follow-up time point. A microfinance intervention for women in South Africa resulted in decreased partner violence and decreased unprotected sex at last sex with non-spousal partners. And finally is another peer-to-peer intervention among female sex workers in India. This was designed to promote acceptance and use of female condoms, and the intervention arm, in fact, had exactly those outcomes. Two new studies remind us of an old truth, which is that harm reduction is an important strategy in addressing IDU epidemics. Needle exchange and methadone maintenance program in Taiwan resulted in a 50% reduction in HIV prevalence in the syringes that were returned to the needle exchange. An analysis of surrogate markers in New York City suggested that after the implementation of needle exchange, most of the IDUs who are HIV positive were infected through sex rather than through IDU. And they did this by using HSV2 as a marker of sexual exposure and HCV as a marker of injecting drug use exposure. So one of the themes that came up in our many conversations with the group, including some late last night, is what does risk really mean? And this is something that we thought we knew, but we found that leaving the conference, we felt like we understood it less well, either at the individual level or the community level. Let me explain what our thoughts were. First, the risk of transmission is highly variable in different scenarios. This slide shows the risk per act with vaginal sex versus anal sex, if a susceptible partner does not or does have an STI, and if a susceptible partner is circumcised or is not circumcised. But we also talked about cross-generational partnerings, for example. So that's at the individual level. At the country level, there's really, I think, been a consensus that in some countries that we label or tag as general epidemics, that there are also concentrated epidemics. And we think that the risk from male-male sex in many countries is probably seriously and systematically under-ascertained. There was a great presentation from the Ukraine whereby my mental math from the slides, there were at least 12,000 MSM infected with HIV and diagnosed, and yet there had only been 129 reports of homosexual transmission to the national surveillance system. This also raises a human rights issue, I think, because until we can provide basic human rights protection that make it safe for people to disclose risk and safe for people to come forward for prevention services, it's difficult either to measure what risk is or to implement prevention programs to address it. We also know that there was some lively discussion about how to characterize risk to populations and implications for prevention, and this refers to the Swiss statement that in some limited cases with special circumstances, risk of transmission from HIV-positive people on effective therapy may be quite low. And there was a pre-conference satellite where this was discussed, and one of the speakers made the point that those special conditions that are required for this statement to be true, namely regular monitoring of therapy, 100% adherence, lack of STIs, are probably very seldom true in Africa. So even though the Swiss representatives pointed out that they intended this statement in a very narrow context, we have to remember that in the world that we live in, with internet, with cell phones, with the way information spreads, that our messages may be heard in different ways. Finally, we point out the lack of access to populations, again because of criminalization and stigmatization, and the lack of tools to accurately measure incidence. We can't implement the very best prevention programs until we can document where that risk exists. So we also are looking forward to Vienna, and when we reconvene in a couple years, here are some things that we hope to see. We'd like to see more data from MSM in unfavorable or hostile environments. So taking these community-based efforts and starting to move them forward into surveillance systems that really document risk systematically, as well as more qualitative work that expands our understanding of the risk context. We look forward to news from randomized controlled trials for microbicides, for PrEP, and for vaccines. We would love to hear about consensus approaches for measuring HIV incidence from biological specimens. And finally, I'd like to close by saying that we've really heard about a great number of HIV prevention efforts which have been grassroots, which have been community-driven, and which have been evaluated in very rigorous ways. And we've also heard about some very big science, big multinational trials that cross continents. But in the end, I think we should measure our success by how well we can meet in the middle of those two worlds, because we want to develop prevention packages that are scientifically sound, that are locally relevant, and that are tailored to the specific risks and prevention needs of all those subpopulations at risk within a given area. Thank you very much.
Our Track D reporter, Social Behavioral Sciences and Health Economics, is Carlos Caceres. Carlos is Principal Professor of Public Health at the Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia in Peru. He is also the Director of the Institute of Health Studies, Sexuality and Human Development.
Good morning. I would like to thank the Scientific Committee for the honor of being here this morning, and to congratulate my Mexican colleagues for the tremendous effort in organizing this, the first International AIDS Conference held in Latin America. Felicitaciones y gracias, amigas y amigos mexicanos. I am extremely grateful for having had the fantastic rapporteur team formed by Dan Allman, Anna Muchastegui, Martin Donohoe, Jackie Gahagan, Antonieta Medina, Rubén Mujica, Jess Ogden, Vera Paiva, Richard Parker, Mario Pecheni, Jimena Salazar, and Anne Varner. I also thank Janelle and Emily for their great support. The Track D presentations were extremely rich in offering critical perspectives of present-day issues. They also provided insight into local experiences and perspectives, adding value to more quantitative forms of data also represented in the conference. A range of emerging voices were heard loudly, and there was a much broader representation of those able to report on specific local realities and communities. New attention was paid to communities traditionally underserved or, worse, previously considered non-existent in the context of HIV/AIDS, such as men who have sex with men in Africa. Finally, reflecting the nature of social science within the region, but also global trends, a strong focus was placed on structural inequalities and social exclusion. renewed attention was paid to the structural and environmental factors shaping the HIV epidemic and to the need for more sophisticated multidimensional programming in response to these factors. In various global settings and for diverse populations, multiple structural inequalities of economics, gender, race, and ethnicity, sexuality, were shown to intersect, fueling stigma and discrimination in shaping HIV vulnerability. Yet it was also clear that structural and environmental factors relate to culture, emotion, and individual subjectivities, including love and relationships, desires for parenthood, as well as sexual desires. These diverse intersections call for the need for a multidimensional response to HIV prevention and care for living people with HIV that seek to change key aspects of the environment in which people carry on with their lives and facilitate protective behaviors. In several sessions, special emphasis was given to innovation in program design, empowerment, and promotion of sexual autonomy, and the need to bring together and engage multiple partners in order to articulate both rights and responsibilities. Evidence from the field of social epidemiology highlighted the crucial role of human rights in maximizing health. A number of presentations provided accounts of the stigma and discrimination faced by diverse marginalized communities. In one session, the case of the Hijras in Delhi, sex workers and their children in Kolkata, and Shan migrants in northern Thailand focused on the social and economic challenges facing individuals in these communities, as well as the effects of the stigma and discrimination. These other stigmas affect access to HIV protective and other health and social services and can result in the abuse of human and political rights. So these were not stories of HIV-related stigma alone, or even mostly, but of a layering of stigma with implications for HIV prevention and service use. Rather than the exception, this layered stigma is almost universal and is, together with resulting discrimination, a product of cultural, historical, political, and economic circumstances. This has critical implications for programmatic responses. Promoting self-organization, for instance, is crucial. Engaging with, listening to, and learning from participants is essential, as is relinquishing control over process and outcomes to those who are meant to benefit from them. Likewise, major structural shifts in policy will greatly facilitate vulnerability and risk reduction among these populations. These shifts can occur through engaging policymakers, the police and security officials, in meaningful dialogue on sensitive issues on sexuality, gender, and rights. All the sessions discuss the fact that despite the recognition that it is difficult to fight and reduce stigma and discrimination, these two manifestations continue to exist due to the fact that both research and action against stigma and discrimination continue to focus on the rational level. There is a pressing need for new interventions that recognize the emotional aspects of these negative responses. Sex between men. This conference has demonstrated the recent long-time due emergence of international interest in the role of men who have sex with men in HIV epidemics globally. This most likely results from new studies showing that the higher burden of HIV among MSM, not only in epidemics classified as concentrated, but also in settings traditionally defined as suffering generalized epidemics. Also from recognition of the role of social exclusion in lowering access to prevention and care among men who regularly or occasionally have sex with other men, regardless of self and social identification. The Jonathan Mann lecture and other sessions presented substantial evidence of this unacceptable health crisis, understood only in a context of invisibility and social exclusion. In most of the world, HIV prevalence is at least over 10 times and usually over 20 times higher in this group than in the general population. In spite of this, surveillance activities usually overlook this group, and public health services are unprepared to meet the prevention and care needs. Not surprisingly, in most countries, this translates into very limited investment in prevention and care for MSM. This is not just about a failed health sector response, though. It is about human rights. Still, a large number of countries in the Caribbean, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and North Africa, and South and Southeast Asia criminalize sodomy. while in others, state violence and human rights violations remain the norm. The controversy around the MSM category was discussed again. Epidemiologically, data are usually presented in terms of MSM as biological males having sex with other biological males. However, structural approaches to reduce vulnerability must focus on social exclusion of all non-heteronormative sexualities, while specific prevention approaches must take into account sexual and gender identities and communities. Numerous presentations and posters describe the diversity of MSM under conditions of vulnerability from settings where MSM were for a long time reported as non-existent. It was also recognized that, at least in lower and middle-income countries where the social organization of same-sex sexual relations does not follow the Western gay pattern, we still lack effective interventions for MSM and hence need to develop them. Also, for the first time, the need to speak separately about transgender persons was broadly discussed. A poster described as transgender side the impact of conceptualizing transgenders as men having sex with men. As explained in a session largely on transgender sex workers, the policy context has been driven by the fact that donor streams and project funding tend to push the issues of transgender sex workers into programs which focus on the broad category of MSM, generally leading to the further invisibility of transgender sex workers, as their HIV prevention, care, treatment, and support needs are often distinct. The great contradiction here is that while transgender individuals may be amongst the most vulnerable to HIV, they are also among the most excluded. More often than not, either services are not available to them or they do not access available services because they do not feel comfortable or safe, nor identify with mainstream groups targeted for interventions. People who inject drugs. Important discussions took place in relation to policies and practices around injection and drug use. In ways more clear than ever before, it was shown that policies based on criminalization and incarceration do not reduce the prevalence of injection drug use. Such policies harm public health by spreading infections. Criticism was also placed on forced drug treatments. It was said that often treatment is the law and supported by the UN, and abuses exist in the name of health. In fact, some forms of drug dependence treatment may constitute cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, even torture. Other sessions discussed more broadly the sometimes contradictory guidelines, recommendations, and policies around injection drug use, asking whether they were based on evidence or on prejudice or ideology. Unfortunately, evidence does not always drive policy. Finally, the need for a minimum package of integrated services for ID use that includes prevention, treatment, and care for HIV, TB, hepatitis, and substance dependence was pointed out. Sex work. In a landmark plenary presentation on sex work at these conferences, Elena Reinaga, herself a sex worker, described the relationship between the absence of human rights, the proliferation of poverty, and HIV prevalence among sex workers. As she explained, despite local, national, and international efforts to sweep sex work under the carpet, nevertheless, we exist and we are here. She eloquently described how sex workers' rights and bodies are still being abused through law enforcement, state violence, and the double stigma of sex work and HIV. Infringement include the challenges of legally registering sex worker organizations, the proliferation of rape and rescue movements, the difficulty of accessing funding for organizations which take a pro-prostitution stance, and the inability of sex workers to access safe, secure, and sufficient supplies of demonstrably effective prevention materials such as condoms. Evidence-based approaches to HIV risk reduction in the context of sex work appear to be mitigated by the accessibility of prevention within a rights-based context. Even when accessible and used correctly, Condoms without human rights are ultimately challenged to prevent HIV. In an environment where only 1 in 3 sex workers has access to HIV prevention and treatment services, the most effective responses seem to be those that empower sex workers to be central to the delivery of peer-based services, approaches which allow sex worker organizations access to funds aimed at prevention, risk reduction, and care. We go back to Elena's words to emphasize sex workers' call for recognition of their basic rights, including the right to be recognized as workers, and the essential autonomy of deciding their life and the future. The importance of gender and sexuality as key contextual elements of HIV work was stressed in a number of sessions. The opening day of the conference provided the framework for the launching of the Gender, Sexuality and HIV Network, formed under the instances of the IAS to maximize the effectiveness of HIV prevention, treatment and care through enhanced communication among researchers and improved utilization of research regarding factors related to gender and sexualities. With regard to power relations, several studies showed evidence of change in sexual relationships among men and women. While women are still victims of violence and coercion, and such violence enhances their vulnerability, a strong message was transmitted to see women not only as victims, but also as autonomous sexual subjects who can and do seek pleasure. There is a need to look at female sexuality not only in context of danger, but also in context of pleasure, because women are capable to know and show what is pleasant for them. Another session addressed the rights of people living with HIV to sexual and reproductive health, focusing on the difficulties faced by positive women when they intend to have children. Presentations argued that positive people are not treated as sexual or reproductive beings, as if their humanness was diminished in the face of HIV status. Based on WHO working definitions of sexual rights, presenters also forwarded positive people's argument under the general frame of human rights. Two approaches to rights were considered fundamental: legal action through the courts and political advocacy. HIV prevention. A symposium of HIV on HIV prevention underscored the urgent need for increased investment in HIV prevention. It was emphasized that politics matter as much as technical issues, that combination prevention is critical, and that HIV prevention must be linked to broader efforts to improve people's lives. Specific presentations focused on biomedical behavior and structural prevention strategies, on the need to better administer what already exists, and on the need for action for the full implementation of combination HIV prevention. Increased investment in political and technical research, a broadened prevention research agenda, and investment in HIV prevention capacities were also seen as important. There was also consensus on the critical need to ramp up existing successful prevention efforts and invest more in promising approaches, while recognizing that there would be no magic bullet. In various sessions, the hot present day debate on circumcision emerged. While acknowledging WHO recommendation of male circumcision as an effective prevention measures, several speakers called for caution regarding its scaling up. Issues to be considered include the health system's preparedness to handle demands, cultural and religious implications, impact on gender norms and masculinity, implications for women, issues of stigma and consent, and issues of communication and potential reduction in condom use. And as one presenter put it, the SNP alone won't do it. There must be a link between the penis and the brain. Young people and children. The conference expanded the space for issues of children beyond the orphan crisis. A critical contextual and structural approach enlightened discussion of affected children's vulnerability. With regard to children, the need to act beyond cliches was stressed. While schools are windows of hope, they are often places for abuse, which do not build skills to make informed decisions. We must achieve real possibilities for making public schools a resource for young people's empowerment. The fact that condom use was rarely discussed is especially worrisome given the ineffectiveness of A-B approaches. The good news was that many faith-based communities and groups funded by conservative actors who started working on A-B perspectives have learned by doing that they need to include condom promotion to respond to this. Living with HIV, access and rights. Several sessions explore the sexual and reproductive health needs, desires and rights of people living with HIV and the current state of linkages between sexual and reproductive health and HIV care services, while recognized by positive people as a critical issue since the beginning of the epidemic, it is now receiving global attention. Nevertheless, there is a lack of consensus among healthcare providers and policymakers about how to address such needs, desires, and rights, and more generally, how to link HIV and sexual and reproductive health services. And while there has been some progress, there are still critical gaps that must be addressed. Regarding scale-up, several sessions discussed the issue of scaling up for universal access to HIV prevention and care. Much attention was paid to the recent debate opposing vertical HIV programming versus investment in HIV care in healthcare systems. A consensus was achieved in the sense that this debate is essentially ideological and not useful to advance the response. Rather, the importance was stressed of operations research to identify weaknesses of healthcare systems that make program implementation difficult, as well as strong monitoring and evaluation. An additional issue discussed was the importance of sustainability in the context of legitimacy and accountability of spending. Preliminary intervention was presented on the role of microfinance as a tool to address poverty among HIV-infected individuals, whether microfinancing prevents HIV transmission by empowering women within the household to demand safe sex practices remains an open question. Shifting of tasks from medical doctors to non-physician healthcare workers is as a strategy was also discussed in ART monitoring. I'm close to the end. Clearly, structural determinants in the spread of HIV require structural interventions. What these need to look like in a realm of new frontiers in HIV prevention sciences is less clear. As discussed in a session, combining the science of the randomized controlled trial in an effort to scale up HIV prevention interventions with the needs of community raises a complex array of social, political, and economic dilemmas. Throughout this conference, we have heard the need for heightened awareness of the wide spectrum of ethical issues in the conduct of sound HIV research globally. This is the case where research is conducted in resource-limited settings or where the research agendas are seen to be driven by funding agencies. As has been pointed out in numerous sessions, there is often a distinct disconnect between the guidelines, laws, and policies in place to ensure ethical conduct of HIV research and the actual processes of undertaking research. We have clearly heard the need for a reinvigorated understanding of the process of understanding HIV/AIDS research and at the international level, which will require rethinking the ethical conduct of such research in our quest for new frontiers, research, and innovation. Finally, all the sessions emphasized that structural vulnerability to HIV should be seen as resulting from the conditions of poverty, violence, and illegality that mobile populations face instead of placing it solely in migrants' individual sexual behavior. Presentations discussed discrimination, criminalization, and xenophobia as important factors for vulnerability, and certain notions about mobile populations as criminals or HIV-infected are at the root of violence and violation of rights, it was said. To conclude, 10 years after the departure of Jonathan Mann, the conference stressed more than any other the role of structural factors and of human rights in HIV vulnerability. A focus of complexity and intersectionality also pointed to the need for comprehensive strategies in prevention and care, abandoning the quest for magic bullets. Controversies in approaches to prevention showed again the importance of transdisciplinary dialogue and transparency. While the importance of increased resources for HIV was acknowledged, they are still insufficient. Seeking additional resources implies ensuring the legitimacy of HIV expenditure through the efficient implementation of an appropriate combination of effective prevention and care programs. Finally, potential political synergies to be developed by groups who struggle for their rights were pointed out as a new thinking force towards improved human rights and eventually universal access. Muchas gracias.
Our rapporteur for Track D, Policy and Political Sciences, is Mandeep Dhaliwal from India. She has worked in the field of HIV for over 17 years and is currently the senior advisor on HIV human rights and health at the Royal Tropical Institute in the Netherlands.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here to present the summary for TRACE on policy and political sciences in a country and a region which has given us some of the finest examples of political commitment and policy leadership in the AIDS response. I would like to begin by thanking the eloquent and energetic members of the rapporteur team for their contributions and their work, and to Janelle Avril for her patience and her support throughout the week. So, some statistics for TRACE. We had 86 abstracts, 46 poster discussions, 702 posters, and numerous cross-cutting bridging and satellite sessions. Needless to say, we didn't cover it all. But what we will try and do is present to you what we thought were the key messages and some of the gaps, and we've organized this in three interconnected areas: international responses and funding, policy analysis and implementation and evaluation, and human rights and law. So international responses and funding. We heard from many speakers that there's lots more money in AIDS now. Donor resources have increased. But based on UNAIDS and World Bank assessments, resources are still dramatically insufficient to meet universal access and health MDG goals. In the majority of cases, domestic contributions to HIV and health lag behind, and international spending needs to increase, as does the spending in middle-income countries in the long-term response to AIDS. We heard from Peter Piot that decisions around funding are political decisions, and what prevents many countries from increasing spending is stigma and discrimination. The unhelpful and false policy debates between AIDS and health systems advocates should not polarize resources for AIDS and health system strengthening. We need more resources for both, and we heard this message at this conference. We heard from many presenters how existing funding mechanisms are not being allocated to where the risk of HIV is the greatest. This is from Dr. Jorge Saavedra's presentation on Tuesday morning. We're not achieving impact, and nor are we getting value for money, because the money is going to the wrong places. We also heard about funding in conflict and post-conflict political crisis situations, that is funding which is, instead of being directed to services for survivors of sexual violence, resources are being invested in services to build democracies and accountable governments. One wonders how accountable the governments can truly be if they can't promote and protect the rights of their own populations, especially those most vulnerable. Many people mention that stigma, discrimination, and violence are the key barriers to effective prevention, treatment, and care. We heard comparatively less about concrete measures to address stigma, discrimination, and violence. There were a few examples of good practice that we heard, such as the Stigma Index, evidence-based stigma reduction programming, and building political leadership. Interestingly, there was no data presented on what level of prevention and treatment resources are being spent on interventions to address stigma and discrimination and violence. It is equally important for us not to track resources and to resource more effectively efforts to address human rights and equity. Several presenters spoke about the need for multiple funding mechanisms in order to make the money work more efficiently and effectively. We also heard about the need for multiple models to ensure that resources reach affected communities. Examples such as the Collaborative Fund showed that community-driven models can get resources to the hard-to-reach, but they do need technical support. It was interesting that we didn't hear too many presentations on technical support, the need to resource technical support and build technical support capacity in the South. We heard about efforts to implement the Paris Declaration, especially focusing on initiatives to improve donor coordination at country level. It is interesting to note that presenters focused primarily on alignment and harmonization at country level, which is but one pillar of the Paris Declaration. With the exception of the Global Fund, which is already reporting results against all principles of the Paris Declaration, other donors said little about their commitments to managing for results and untying aid, also important parts of the Paris Declaration. While President Clinton may well have the perfect candidate in mind to head the recently proposed UN Agency on Women, that by in itself is no reason to assume that this new agency will effectively meet the needs of women and girls. Maybe we missed something. Are women and girls not within the remit of existing UN agencies? Imagine the numbers of male and female condoms, clean needles, and medicines we could buy for what it would cost to set up and run another UN agency. Current current accountability mechanisms do not effectively translate into concrete actions and consequences. We heard this from many speakers. There are no robust accountability mechanisms, and UNAIDS' ability to hold national governments to account is, of course, limited. Citizens must do more to hold their governments to account in terms of their existing AIDS and health commitments. It was refreshing to hear at an AIDS conference, or anywhere for that fact, discussions about how IMF policies are restricting fiscal space, which contributes to weakening health systems and thus is an impediment to achieving universal access. We heard about IMF policies in Kenya and Uganda, which lead to these countries exporting health workers, even in a situation where there's health worker crises in their countries. One wonders who the IMF is accountable to and who holds the IMF accountable. So our next set of findings is on policy analysis, implementation, and evaluation. One of the strongest and most common messages at this conference has been about the need for better evidence-based policies. We heard far too many examples of when evidence has been deliberately and systematically ignored or questioned, ill-informed policies implemented, resulting in human rights violations and precious resources being wasted. Three egregious examples were presented during the past week. One, in spite of irrefutable evidence about the effectiveness of harm reduction, evidence-based policies and programs for people who use drugs are still not being implemented universally. How much more evidence do we need? This begs the question, who is funding all these non-evidence-based interventions that do exist for people who use drugs? An equally compelling example of bad practice is PEPFAR. In spite of clear evidence-based recommendations from the Institute of Medicine's midterm evaluation of PEPFAR about the need to do away with regressive measures such as the AB earmark, the anti-prostitution loyalty oath, the gag rule, and the ban on federal funding for needle and syringe programs, the recently reauthorized PEPFAR has failed to respond to these evidence-based recommendations. In fact, PEPFAR II has kept all these ideology-based provisions and even extended their impact by expanding the conscience clause to include care as an activity that organizations may refuse to provide on moral and religious objection. This is a shameful matter which I feel that even civil society has just let slip by and needs to do much more about. In spite of the body of evidence showing the importance of integrating and linking HIV prevention with reproductive health and family planning services, PEPFAR continues the trend of scaling up HIV programming whilst neglecting to provide any additional resources for sexual and reproductive health. Another important message at this conference was about the need for policies which relate to people's daily lives, policies which meet people where they are, in bedrooms and in the bush, having sex for pleasure, having sex for money, HIV-positive people having sex and babies. We heard also about the destructive impacts of policy incoherence and the lack of policy leadership. We heard about the lack of incoherent policy on harm reduction. We also heard about the lack, and every day in this conference, actually, we heard about the lack of policy coherence and prevarication in the development of the UN Sex Work Guidance Note. In 2007, UNAIDS developed a guidance note on sex work which can be misinterpreted as promoting an authoritarian approach to sex work, which thus increases vulnerability to HIV due to human rights abuses, including rape and murder. The guidance note aims to reduce sex work as opposed to focusing on reducing HIV in sex work contexts. The guidance note is also silent on male and transgender sex workers. What is equally disturbing is that when UN staff were asked about the status of the guidance note, some didn't bother to reply. But others said, well, it's just a UN document, and the lack of guidance doesn't prevent good work from happening in communities. Comments such as this demonstrate a fundamental lack of leadership and a failure of governance. Sex workers are one of the most marginalized and vulnerable groups, and it is the UN's mandate, as per the UN Charter, to uphold the rights of marginalized, vulnerable, and poor communities. In terms of gaps in policy implementation, presentations on violence against sex workers in the DRC and inheritance law in Zimbabwe pointed out that human rights abuses against women are taking place despite the existence of supportive policies. The same is true for implementation of policies and frameworks for the meaningful engagement of people living with HIV, civil society, and marginalized communities. We heard a great many examples showing the importance of meaningful involvement of affected communities in policy development processes, but heard less about where and how this is happening. We heard from Zimbabwe again that women are raped as punishment for the wrong political affiliation. How can we expect women to participate in policy development processes when such practices prevail with impunity? There are a few good examples of good practice and advocacy for policy change. For example, in the Ukraine, where people who use drugs were supported both financially and technically to advocate for access to oral substitution therapy. Networks of HIV-positive women from India, Mexico, and the UK showed the importance of providing legal support alongside capacity building for advocacy and policy engagement. There were also examples of civil society organizing to document human rights abuses in countries such as Jamaica. One paper discussed the development and use of diverse and inclusive transnational networks as being the key to the success of the advocacy and work of the Treatment Action Campaign. The use of information technology and communication, ITC, was critical to the success of this model, and ITC also helped to bring the world's attention to human rights violations of sex workers in Cambodia. ITC will feature critically in terms of advocacy and activism for the long-term response in AIDS. Several speakers presented that advocacy and activism in the long-term AIDS response would need to ensure the necessary political leadership and the respect for human rights, and that advocacy and activism would have to be confrontational, constructive, and be based on optimism and an ambition for social justice. What was notable about this track was that we didn't hear very much about policy evaluation and impact, and hopefully in Vienna we will hear more. On to human rights and the law. So this was a really exciting conference in terms of human rights. It was a conference of many firsts. It was a conference where we had a significant focus on women's rights and the sexual and reproductive health rights of people living with HIV. We talked about race, AIDS, and inequalities. Maybe in 2010 we'll talk more about these issues and also have the courage to speak about corruption and AIDS. We had a plenary address on sex work given by a sex worker, some attention to transgender and indigenous issues, and it was one of the first global assessments of the systematic failure to respond to MSM epidemics, a gross violation of human rights. This was a conference where it was okay to talk about the rights of bad women in a way that it hasn't been spoken of before. This was also a conference which dispelled some myths around human rights. For those of you, and we heard several people in the corridor saying, well, actually, you know, there's nothing here for me at the conference. I'm from Africa, and, you know, this MSM, sex work, IDU stuff, we don't have that in Africa. Well, this conference has proved you wrong. We heard lots of evidence in presentations time and time again that these populations exist everywhere, regardless of culture, religion, history, or political context. We heard many examples of communities mobilizing to respond where governments have failed to act. Men who have sex with men from all over Africa, drug users in Thailand, and sex workers in Cambodia. So this is a slide from a poster presented by Sophia Gruskin. The slide shows that a large number of countries are reporting that they have policies to ensure universal access. However, what we learned from the civil society shadow reports was that the reality of universal access, in spite of this proliferation of policies to ensure universal access, is something quite different. Again, highlighting the importance of civil society shadow reports and those to be taken more formally into account. This slide shows that 63% of countries report laws, regulations, and policies that impede access to effective HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support for key populations. And disturbingly, we also heard that 78% of countries have no performance indicators for human rights compliance. We also heard about the courageous report from the Commission on AIDS in Asia, which concluded that programs which stigmatize key populations must not be implemented, And if countries hope to reverse the tide of AIDS in the region, they must, as a matter of priority, decriminalize sex work and homosexuality, remove, alter, or relax enforcement of legal barriers which impede harm reduction. All that remains now is for political leaders to show some courage in implementing these recommendations at scale. Numerous presentations on criminalization highlighted the proliferation of highly useless laws, which have no proven public health benefit. We heard about the misguided model law from Chad, funded by Futures Constello Project, which is resulting in a number of criminalizing type policies. And we also heard that while criminalization is posited as a means of protecting women, we heard from several presenters that it can, in fact, make women more vulnerable. For example, women being harassed and prosecuted, or women being deterred from accessing HIV services. We also heard several sessions on travel restrictions, as well as restrictive immigration and residence policies. We heard that travel restrictions generally target non-nationals, and even though in countries most infections are transmitted by nationals. And we also heard that law and policy won't work if it is not enforced, or if the enforcers are the perpetrators of the violence. Finally, what was missing at the conference? Intellectual property and trade. There were just a few sessions. While the costs of first-line ARVs have come down in many places, we heard from other presenters that the cost of second-line salvage therapy medicines and medicines for Hep C are still prohibitively expensive in most of the world. The patent regime is still a major barrier to achieving and sustaining universal access. Somehow the heart seems to have gone out of the global mobilization to challenge the patent regime. While we heard of short-term solutions to reduce prices, such as the patent pool, these are short-term, temporary solutions. What we need to do is stop accepting the dogma of pharmaceutical companies and the governments that profit from them, and to advocate for a system that will make medicines accessible to the rich, the poor, and the marginalized in an equitable manner. Human rights are an important means for structural interventions that address social causes of health. Without addressing the underlying causes that shape inequalities and social injustice, interventions help those affected by dominance deal with the dominance rather than addressing the dominance itself. Empowerment, or ceding power and control of the communities that we work with, is essential. Final slide, I promise. In 2005, world leaders committed to delivering universal access by the end of 2010. We were reminded by Greg Gonsalves that according to the UNAIDS 2008 report, bizarrely, the definition of universal access now means partial access. Even the target year seems to have shifted. We heard some people talking about universal access by 2015. We hope that in Vienna that we will hold ourselves and our leaders and our donors accountable to the target of universal access by 2010. Finally, in order to achieve universal access, human rights for all must truly be at the heart of the AIDS response. Otherwise, the AIDS response will have lost its heart and its hope, and we will fail to deliver universal access by 2010.
Thank you. Thank you. Annelies Messman from the Netherlands has been tracking all of the youth sessions and events across this conference. Annelies works for an organization called Choice, a Dutch youth organization that promotes the sexual and reproductive health rights for young people.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Buenas tardes, todas y todos. I'm honored to have the opportunity to report to all of you today on the exciting and intense week that we have shared together in this beautiful city of Mexico. As you've just heard, I'm the Chief Youth Rapporteur at the 2008 International AIDS Conference, and therefore I will do my best to report to you what this conference has meant for young people. I will also talk about what I perceive as the major highlights of the conference. From my perspective as a young person, I think there are five words that express most clearly what was most significant about this conference. Visibility, prevention, partnership, leadership, and human rights. First, I will talk about visibility. At the 2006 Toronto AIDS Conference, young people came together as the Toronto Youth Force. We announced to the world that we were disproportionately affected by the epidemic. We announced to the world that we were major stakeholders in the response to the epidemic. And we announced to the world that we were ready to play our part. From Barcelona to Bangkok to Toronto to Mexico, the Youth Force has become bigger and stronger. There were more young people at this conference than ever before. There were more young people as speakers, as presenters, in plenaries, panels, and sessions than ever before. Young people were involved in the organization of the conference and made important distributions to the discussions that took place in and out of the session rooms. Young people were recognized for their scientific contribution with the Young Investigators Award. In terms of visibility, this conference was a landmark for the community of people living with HIV, men having sex with men, injection drug users, and sex workers. People living with HIV were at the center of this conference. For the first time, there was a plenary session on men having sex with men and an international march against homophobia. All of us saw, hopefully not for the last time, Methadone Man and Buenafriend Girl in their attractive costumes drawing attention to the issues of harm reduction. We saw sex workers speaking out for their rights and protesting against UNAIDS draft guidance note on commercial sex work and PEPFAR anti-prostitution pledge. Yet, much remains to be seen in terms of visibility. We heard calls about the lack of data on youth issues. We heard calls about the lack of data and attention to the effect of the epidemic on lesbians. We heard similar calls from transgender people and other sexual minorities. And there are many calls we did not hear and people we did not see. Next, I want to talk about prevention. A week before the conference, the UNAIDS epidemic report showed that for every two people who have access to HIV treatment, five people get newly infected. With more than 45% of all new infections amongst young people between the ages of 15 and 24, about 3,000 young people get infected daily. That is two every minute. This conference saw a renewed interest and commitment to working on prevention. This conference recognized the importance of positive prevention for people living with HIV. The pendulum is swinging back from treatment to prevention. This conference also saw a more comprehensive approach to prevention. Earlier, we were asked why information didn't automatically lead to behavioral change. Earlier, we heard questions such as, why do young people engage in risky behavior despite knowing the risks? Today, we have begun to see how poverty, inequality, stigma, discrimination, criminalization, unemployment, violence, disability, fundamentalism, humanitarian crisis, and other social factors are barriers to effective prevention. Today, we have begun seeing evidence that shows how prevention programs that address social determinants are more effective and more sustainable. Today, we have begun to see the role that new technology and communication can play in the impact of prevention programs. While looking at the virus, we cannot ignore the terrain. Prevention programs must be based on evidence and address the realities of young people. My third observation is about partnerships. The Mexico Youth Force was built by young people of 75 youth organizations coming together for a common purpose. It brought together young people from different organizations, countries, cultures, HIV statuses, religious beliefs, gender, sexual orientation, and backgrounds. Under the Youth Partnerships Initiative of the World AIDS Campaign, young leaders from the Youth Pre-Conference interacted and built partnerships with other young leaders from the Economical Pre-Conference, the Labor Pre-Conference, the Sex Workers Pre-Conference, and the MSM Pre-Conference. There was the recognition that young people are not a single homogeneous group. We are part of every group and represent every constituency. Positive young leaders across the spectrum met and formed partnerships. Young people begin and strengthen partnerships with civil society, governments, and international institutions. If AIDS has taught us anything, it is that we need to unite and build partnerships. Constituencies of stakeholders working in the response to HIV and AIDS need to find common ground and work together. The partnerships we have built and continue to build are valuable resources that will bring us closer to universal access. Yet, more needs to be done to bridge gaps that exist. Researchers and human rights activists need to work closer together. International institutions and grassroots communities need to sit at the same table. Constituencies that have never worked together before will need to find a common language. They will need to build trust and skills in order to communicate better. We all need to build partnerships to ensure that enough resources are mobilized to fund the response to HIV/AIDS. We need to build partnerships to ensure that those resources we have already mobilized are spent effectively. And this includes funding for young people's sexual and reproductive rights and youth-led initiatives to provide a platform for meaningful youth participation. Such partnerships must be equal and respectful. Young people should not be involved in any peripheral or tokenistic way, but as decision makers in their own right, in the design, implementation, and evaluation of programs and policies that affect us. My fourth observation is about leadership. At the youth pre-conference, Dr. Pedro Kahn took the lead by being a dependable ally of the Mexico Youth Force. The Mexican Minister of Health, Mr. Cordoba Villarobos, took the lead by making a commitment to young people at the Youth Pavilion. Heads of UN agencies, including Peter Piot from UNAIDS and Soraya Obeid and Purnima Mane from UNFPA, took the lead by engaging in several conversations with young people. Leaders of business, such as Bill Rohde of MTV, took the lead by promising to establish a youth advisory board to review and advise on all MTV programming for young people. The International AIDS Society took the lead to put together an ambitious and challenging agenda. The executive director of the society, Craig McClure, took the lead by announcing he is committed to supporting the leadership of young people in the response to HIV and AIDS. And it goes without saying that young people have taken the lead again and again to speak out about the issues that concern them and to advocate for their rights. While this is heartening, there are still those who are silent on young people's issues. There are still those who don't meaningfully engage young people. And there are still those who deny young people the rights to decide on all programs and policies that affect their lives. There are still those who do not take the lead and do not take responsibility. Young people urge each person in civil society, government, and international institutions to take the lead on youth issues. Young people urge the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, to take the lead on youth issues. Finally, I want to talk about human rights. What will probably be remembered as the major achievement of this conference is the renewed emphasis on the centrality of human rights. This conference recognized that now, more than ever, human rights must occupy the center of our response to HIV and AIDS. Yesterday afternoon, I saw all the diverse individuals, organizations, and institutions that have been affected by the epidemic rally around human rights. A key demand of young people working on HIV and AIDS has been the promotion and protection of their human rights to comprehensive and accurate information and education about HIV and AIDS. This week, the meeting of Ministers of Health and Education of Latin America and Caribbean countries committed in declaration to providing young people comprehensive sexuality education. This is a good beginning, but it does not end here. The challenge will be to ensure that these ministers remain accountable to their promises. The challenge will be to ensure that decision makers remain accountable to the declarations that they have signed. The challenge will be to ensure that we hold each other accountable for the failure to meet progress to universal access by 2010. The challenge will be to advocate for governments of all countries to commit to protection and promotion of the broad range of human rights, including sexual and reproductive rights. The challenge will be to ensure that these human rights become accessible to all people, regardless of their age, gender, sexual orientation, profession, drug use, HIV positive, or other status. This conference was an opportunity to review the progress we have made and to look at the lessons learned and to plan our efforts for the future. We have our work set out for us. We have our commitments before us. The next conference in Vienna will be a similar opportunity for all of us engaged in the response to HIV and AIDS to come together and to hold each other accountable. It has been a privilege to report on the happenings of the pre-conference and the main conference for the past week and a half. And I was fortunate to have the help and support of several people who I'd like to thank. Mara, Pratik, Caroline, Claudia, Delilah, and Rayon. Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Annalise, and thank you especially for being 2 minutes under time. We have two more speakers, and I'd like to ask them to be very specifically, to stay very specifically within their time. We have the mayors coming over for the closing, and timing is on a very strict schedule. So next, the community rapporteur for AIDS 2008 is Terry Anderson. Terry is a man living with HIV and has been an AIDS activist for the past 25 years.
Buenas tardes a todos. Good afternoon. I know everyone was expecting acrobats and fireworks to compete with the Beijing opening ceremonies, but the fact that you're here watching PowerPoint presentations is a true testament to your commitment. It is impossible to give a comprehensive view of the community experience and the community perspective at a conference where community permeates every aspect of what we talk about and what we do. But I'm going to try to give a short version of that. And we're going to try to make sure that we have no computer problems. Like everyone else up here, I want to thank the incredible people who worked on the rapporteur team. If you've never done it, you should do it sometime just so you can promise yourself you'll never do it again. It involves committing yourself for a week to going to conferences, going to sessions, writing them up, working incredibly hard. I was fortunate to have an incredible team who met all their deadlines, was smart and understood what was going on, and made my job a whole lot easy. When the Community Program Committee put together the Community Program for this conference, they laid out a number of issues that they wanted to make sure happened. They laid out a vision for the Community Program. And this summarized here. They wanted to reclaim the ownership of the agenda for the community. They wanted to reach and involve diverse communities in the conference. They wanted to make sure that issues of human rights, social justice, and economic inequality were fully and comprehensively addressed here. They wanted to bring together community and evidence-based science in one setting. They wanted to ensure a long-term legacy for Mexico and for the region. And they want all of us to demand accountability and action from the institutions that are part of the global AIDS response. The question of whether or not these goals were met, in fact, we'll tell you not just did the community program succeed, but in fact, did the entire conference succeed? I want to start by asking a question, which is, what is the place of community at this conference? Is it the long march across the Hippodrome, over to the Global Village, one that some people viewed as simply symbolic and some people viewed as a major barrier? Or is this the place of people living with HIV and AIDS, with members of marginalized communities, with people from around the world at this conference? Is it behind these podiums? Is it on the session panels? And I think from the community point of view, we can say emphatically, it is both. We need to be honest, though, that when we talk about the place of community in this conference, there's an ongoing set of issues around that. And if you didn't see the Mexican wrestling yesterday morning at the Global Village, you missed something. That picture is from there. We need to address the question of why do so many scientists choose to go to pathogenesis and other conferences and not come here? And what does that rob them of, and what does that rob us of? We need to ask the question of, do we truly have one conference that scientists and community all go to, or do we have a number of conferences that each of us only interact in our small worlds? How do we overcome that division? And how do we make sure we're maximizing every opportunity to build interdisciplinary sessions, to build networking across the traditional boundaries that have divided us in the field of AIDS work? I want to start by asking, does it matter that community's here? Why does it matter? What difference does it make if people living with HIV and AIDS, if sex workers, if men who have sex with men, if poor people, if the homeless, if young people are part of these sessions or not? And I think we need to say very clearly, it matters, it makes a difference. It matters when a sex worker stands up on this podium and talks about personal experience instead of a researcher telling you what they think that experience was. We noted as we were covering different kinds of sessions, there were a number of sessions where we had one, the topic being covered first in an oral abstract session, which was all very scientific and technical, and you had the great pie charts and all that kind of stuff. And then you had another one, which was an interdisciplinary or non-abstract driven one, where community people were at the table. And the discussion was different. When you had HIV positive people talking about HIV positive sexuality and HIV prevention, it wasn't a discussion of us as vectors of infection. It was a discussion of meeting the prevention needs of people living with HIV and AIDS. When you talk about criminalization, when you run the risk of going to jail yourself, you have a different perspective on it than if you're a law professor just researching it. And the reality is, in many places, we were able to bring a greater richness to this conference by bringing those voices to the table in interdisciplinary sessions, in non-abstract driven sessions, and in abstract driven sessions. And we need to continue to do that. But we also need to ask ourselves, where are we not doing that? For example, there's been a fair number of sessions at this conference dealing with the question of scaling up male circumcision. Well, we're about to cut many millions of men's penises. Did we bring any of those men into the sessions to talk about what they thought about that? And don't we think that if we look to scale up, we better take that into account before we start doing the cutting? As I've emphasized before, I think we've had an incredible amount of positive feedback from people from all disciplines about the value of the bridging sessions, of the special sessions, of the non-abstract driven sessions, of the plenaries, because it does allow us to break out of some of our traditional boundaries of what we think our role is at the conference and talk to people we wouldn't normally talk to. And one of the greatest strengths of this conference is it offers us the opportunity to do that if we take advantage of the opportunity. It is incredibly encouraging that approximately 12,000 of the attendees at this conference were first-time attendees, nearly 60% of the conference goers. We need to be prepared to ask, are we doing a good job for them? Some of us have been to, you know, 8, 10, 12 conferences. We know our way around these things. Are we doing a good job for the people who are showing up here for the first time? Are we maximizing their experience so that when they leave here and go back home, it isn't just that they remember getting lost in the hallway or having trouble finding the bathroom or not getting a bus back to their hotel, that what they're remembering is the lessons that they can learn to go back and scale up treatment, the lessons they can learn and go back and make better policy, the lessons they can do to do better prevention. We need to make sure that that's what people walk away with from the conference by making the conference experience as positive and as simple as possible for people. Moving on to the next major theme that we identified in our session is the question of how communities are partners. How are we partners with researchers, with governments, with international agencies, with funders? And there were a tremendous number of sessions presented at this conference which dealt with that question. I'm going to focus first on research and touch on the others much more briefly. there were a number of great sessions which told us very clearly that for partnership with community to be effective, to build better clinical trials, to build better prevention trials, to do better operational research, you had to start early. Waiting until you're about to roll out the study and putting your CAB together after that is way too late in the game. You need to be preparing community. You need to be understanding what the community needs are. Don't wait. We heard a lot of examples of where it didn't go so well, where, you know, drug users in Thailand weren't brought in early. And as a result, the trial itself was controversial. The results were not very definitive, and it had to be extended for a couple of years. We have to look at understanding that it's not just doing this because it's the right thing. It's doing it because it makes the research better, it makes it easier to conduct the trials, and we'll get better information as a result of it. We also need to think very clearly about how we build the capacity of the people we rely on to be community. I'll touch on this very briefly a bit later, but we frequently bring people to the table with no clear expectation of what their responsibilities are, with no investment in building their human capacity, and then we wonder why we fail. And we heard in numerous sessions here that if you do it right, you can do a really good job of it. Finally, I want to acknowledge that in many places, we're able to have research generated from community. You know, there's talk of rectal microbicide research happening. That isn't happening because the drug companies are seeing a market for it. It's happening because people from communities are saying that they have a need for it. And we need to think about how we change the research paradigm so that, in fact, community need is driving that. We saw a number of issues around the question of, is there trust between community and partners? Are people willing to trust us in the community with the information? Certainly there's controversies about the Swiss statement and what should people really be saying to people living with HIV and AIDS around that. We saw in the United States the problem of when the CDC held on to really important public health information for almost a year when it should have been out there and been shared with community so that changes could have been made in national prevention programs in the United States. I heard a lot from community members questioning, where are we really on GEPA, on the greater involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS, not just in this conference, but in the AIDS movement overall. Are we just now checking the box and doing tokenism, and are we prepared to make sure that we're innovating and improving what we do for GEPA? And one of the suggestions that frequently came out in the sessions was not talking about involvement of people with AIDS, but talking about investment in people with AIDS, to make sure that we are investing in the organizations and the individuals who can provide the true, meaningful community voices. Similarly, I want to acknowledge an incredible experiment that happened here. Health and Development Networks brought 7 children to this conference to be reporters. You don't just get 7 kids on a plane without doing a lot of advance work, without making sure that you've got planning for everything. It takes money, it takes time, but we now have 7 young people who know more about HIV and AIDS than anybody else in their age group does, who are going to be resources for us as the future goes on. And we need to acknowledge that that kind of upfront investment will pay off in the long run. We heard from so many communities at this conference, and I'm not going to be able to do more than fly through them, but I want to acknowledge them. The voices of sex workers were heard more loudly and more clearly at this conference than at any previous international AIDS conference. And as a former sex worker, I have to tell you that it means something to have us talking for ourselves as opposed to have other people talking for us. Clearly, in a region of the world where the epidemic is being driven through same-sex, male-to-male sexual transmission, we heard more about men who have sex with men than we have at any previous conference since the early days of this epidemic. And that is a monster. We heard, and I think it's particularly important to acknowledge, being here in Mesoamerica, that we heard the voices of indigenous people, a long overlooked group that has particular vulnerabilities, growing epidemics in many countries, and that we have to put on the agenda for global organizations to make sure that their needs do not go ignored any longer. And again, there are so many communities. I wish I could, you know, in the few minutes I have, run through them all, but I want to acknowledge that we heard those voices. Did we hear them loud enough? Many of them, no. did we hear the consistent messages do we need? This wasn't a conference that dealt with gender-based issues as much as some of the previous ones did, and maybe it should have. This is a conference that dealt much, much more with specialized epidemics than generalized epidemics. And as a result, I think many people felt that there was a missing element of the African epidemic in this conference that needed to be addressed at a much higher level. I do want to acknowledge, and I hope all of you made it over there, the Global Village was an incredible center of networking, of activity, of activism throughout this conference, and I think it showed us how to start to mobilize the energy of community into meaningful involvement in a conference, in a worldwide response. We need to acknowledge, as others have, that we finally have gotten a human rights approach front and center in responding to this epidemic. But we need to go beyond that, from human rights to think about social justice. We're talking about the reality that this epidemic is being driven not just by violations of rights, it's being driven by poverty, it's being driven by homelessness, it's being driven by huge social inequities that we have to address structurally as well as legally and policy-wise. It's going to be an incredible problem to get it accomplished, but we must move forward with it. Finally, I want to end by talking about what is the place of this conference in the community. We're here in Mexico City, and there's no question that it's having an impact. If you understand Spanish, if you read the newspapers or watch the news, you know how much coverage this is getting. And I think it's really great to talk about the fact that here in Mexico City, we managed to get the government to change its policy around opiate substitution for delegates coming to this conference. So the real question becomes, will that policy change last? And will it spread throughout the rest of Latin America to countries that do not currently allow methadone and buprenorphine? We need to make sure that it does. We need to make sure that when we finally get the president of Mexico talking openly about homophobia, a pretty unprecedented and unbelievable event, that that results in follow-through, that that's the beginning, not the end of the process. We need to realize that there's a tremendous amount that happened with community organizations in this country around this epidemic, but it's not enough to just leave it. We have to stay connected and committed and in touch with those networks, with those activists, so that our impact here is not just a week of taxi fares, but it's a truly lasting impact on HIV and AIDS in this country. I want to very quickly shout out the fact that we've had a lot of interesting ways to expand participation in this conference. We are all privileged. We get to come here, either we pay our way or somebody else pays our way. I want to acknowledge that IAS has done a great job of setting up hubs around the world where people could participate electronically in this conference. The Kaiser Family Foundation has done a great job on broadcasting many of the proceedings on their website. That we've seen activist blogs from the community reporting on this. That we've seen community media from throughout Latin America and throughout the world here. So we're not just relying on BBC and CNN, but in fact we have voices of community reporting on this. We need to maximize that. And finally, as we think about where we go, one of the favorite quotes I heard all week was somebody talking about the Global Village, and they said it was messy, sloppy, and noisy, and they meant that in a good way. And I think that's a reflection. Community is messy, sloppy, and noisy. The epidemic is messy, sloppy, and noisy. That's where we need to be. That's where this conference needs to be. We need to find a way to harness that energy, which, let's face it, in many ways have been lost in the AIDS movement. As we've grown into a multi-billion dollar industry, we've lost a lot of the original energy. We saw a lot of that over in the Global Village. We need to figure out how to bring that back into the center of the International AIDS Conference and of the entire international response to AIDS. Thank you very much.
Finally, our leadership rapporteur this year is Nathan Geffen, who works for the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa.
There are many HIV-related issues that need better leadership. However, I shall focus on the ones that were emphasized at this conference. But first, we have a duty to remember those of our leaders who could not be at this conference. As the Beijing Olympics open, human rights and AIDS activist Hu Jia is serving a 3.5-year sentence for inciting subversion. According to Amnesty International, The court verdict states that one aspect of his crime was to accept interviews with the foreign media in order to incite others to subvert state power. The last time he was in prison, he was beaten with electroshock batons. Amnesty also states that Khujia suffers from liver disease due to hepatitis B infection. Prison authorities verbally rejected his application for medical parole on 5 June 2008, telling his family that according to regulation, he could only apply for this after he finished one-third of his sentence. The family has been unable to provide him with medicine. He is receiving some medication from prison authorities, but his family are concerned that this may not be adequate. Much of the conference focused on evidence-based prevention, with particular emphasis on harm reduction, sex education, and circumcision. Peter Piot has called for an active coalition between a prevention movement and people living with HIV, and to link this coalition with other motors of social change, including treatment activists and women and youth activists. Jerry Stimson said, "In an ideal world, policy would be driven by evidence." He noted that there is 20 years of evidence showing that methadone, clean needles, and syringes are effective in reducing risk of HIV transmission. Yet half of countries with intravenous drug users have no harm reduction programs. PEPFAR continues to prohibit its funds from being used for needle exchange. Both Stimson and Mark Harrington pointed out the lack of evidence to support punitive drug control measures. Stimson cited Russia, the United States, and Iran in particular for their inconsistent policies towards AIDS, towards drug users, some of them evidence-driven, but some of them ideologically driven. Douglas Kirby presented evidence showing that abstinence-only programs do not work. By contrast, he showed sex education programs do not increase sexual activity, contrary to a popular ideologically driven dogma. He also presented evidence that there are comprehensive sex education and STD HIV education programs that reduce risk-taking behavior. What's more, some of these programs have been replicated in diverse settings. Some of them delay initiation of sexual debut, reduce number of sexual partners, and increase condom and contraception use. It is the duty of activists to learn the content of these programs and to campaign relentlessly for them, and as relentlessly against abstinence-only programs and PEPFAR's abstinence clauses. Richard White, Frederick Sauer, and Bertrand Auver have once more presented compelling evidence of the efficacy of circumcision to reduce HIV transmission in generalized heterosexual populations. White demonstrated that circumcision is cost-effective. Auver showed that uptake of circumcision is high in a research project in Orange Farm, South Africa. And furthermore, Dirk Tulliard presented evidence in a late breaker showing that circumcision reduces the risk of men contracting HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer. Epidemiological models were presented that show HIV incidence among women would drop as well. It is now a year and a half since the third clinical trial showing the effectiveness of circumcision was published, yet no sub-Saharan African country has adopted a policy to introduce voluntary male medical circumcision in health facilities beyond research sites. This prevarication is a serious leadership failure, not only by politicians, but also by activists who have also offered a plethora of pseudoscientific excuses not to proceed with this life-saving intervention. Yes, there are remaining research questions about circumcision, but no one in this hall would accept that the antiretroviral rollout should have been delayed until we knew every last detail about this intervention. By Vienna in 2010, circumcision should be a part of the standard part of a combination of prevention interventions offered in countries with generalized heterosexual epidemics. A major focus of the conference was stigma and discrimination against men who have sex with men, transgendered people, and sex workers. Many calls have been made at the conference to decriminalize sex work. Nandini Bandopadhyay pointed out that there is compelling evidence that the substantive involvement of sex workers in prevention interventions makes these interventions effective and sustainable. Yet, as she explained, sex work remains widely criminalized, and even where countries such as India introduce progressive legislation, it is often done inconsistently. Roy Chan pointed out how continued criminalization of homosexuality in Singapore and other countries, including Iran and several African countries, rendered interventions in the MSM community difficult. He cited Australia's excellent response to the HIV epidemic, which coincided with its decrim of homosexuality. We heard disturbing descriptions of official homophobia in the Middle East and North Africa, but we also heard of efforts to begin addressing this. Jorge Saavedra described the pioneering work of Mexico to reduce homophobia. Apart from the fact that reducing discrimination is necessary and an urgent prevention measure, we as leaders in the struggle against HIV should in any event condemn oppressions against sexual minorities simply because they violate human rights. Another policy gaining currency around the world that is incongruent with evidence is criminalization. Edwin Cameron this morning has offered 10 reasons against criminalization, summarized eloquently by Michaela Caton. She stated that proponents of legislation for criminalization might have good intentions, but that it does not succeed in reducing the spread of HIV. Instead, criminalization deters people from testing, spreads misinformation about HIV, creates a false sense of security, and stigmatizes HIV-positive people as criminals. At the same session, Vianney Jacobs told his own personal story about being diagnosed with HIV and not receiving counseling, battling depression, attempting suicide, and realizing that he had infected his girlfriend. He stated the importance of examining the complexity of the transmission of HIV and not resorting to simplistic responses like criminalization. We must not forget that the most effective and important intervention, both for treatment and prevention, is antiretroviral medication. This conference heard many times that 3 million people are on treatment and that PMTCT rollout has improved. But as pointed out by Kieran Daly and Michelle Sidibe, we are off track to meet the UNGAS target set in 2006 for both of these. At the current rate of new people initiating treatment, by 2010 only 4.6 million people will go on to antiretrovirals instead of over 8 million. Linda Richter pointed out poor progress in getting children on treatment. She also emphasized the need for parents to access treatment. If we miss the UNGAS targets, there is little chance of meeting the key Millennium Development Goals by 2015. Anton Pozniak reminded us that while most developing countries are accessing treatment, many have poor access to better drugs, such as tenofovir, atazanavir, one-pill-a-day regimens, and the new generation of antiretrovirals. Consequently, we are stuck with unacceptably high levels of lipodystrophy and lactic acidosis in developing countries. Greg Gonsalves criticized the unacceptable backtrack and mealy-mouthed language on universal access by 2010 in the UNAIDS 2008 report on the global AIDS epidemic. Greg, Peter Piot, and Mark Harrington also strongly criticized the backlash against AIDS programs, as articulated most prominently by Roger England in a recent issue of the British Medical Journal. AIDS programs are the best chance we have of building successful primary healthcare systems in the developing world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. And as Greg emphasized, it is AIDS activists and health workers who have implemented the principles of Alma Ata, which emphasize primary healthcare based on science and technology made universally accessible. Greater investment is needed in healthcare infrastructure and to combat other diseases, including malaria, diabetes, cancer, and heart disease. But total funding for healthcare must be increased, not shifted from AIDS to other diseases. It is the AIDS model that should be emulated, not destroyed by old public health arguments that have failed us. Connecting with this theme, Bill Clinton emphasized investment in both targeted AIDS programs and broad public health infrastructure. The infrastructure built for AIDS programs has enhanced the capacity of the health system to respond to all diseases. The dire human resources crisis in poor countries that HIV has revealed was always there. We are now simply providing more essential services, while previously public health experts were prepared to let chronic diseases in poor people go untreated. We have seen moving examples of leadership in the conference. Vuyiseka Dubula of the Treatment Action Campaign and representatives of Community Health Media Trust have explained how the mass rollout of treatment literacy has empowered people, especially women, at community level to campaign for treatment and prevention. Vuyiseka further pointed out how TAC is leading a campaign against violence against women, the ugly fuel of many HIV infections. We heard the Lesotho Minister of Health, Dr. Mpu Ramatlapeng, explain how Lesotho, one of the world's poorest countries, has shown the political will to conduct a mass testing campaign and to roll out treatment to 122 of its 156 health facilities. But Dr. Ramatlapeng and her counterparts across the continent need more donor aid if their life-saving programs are to scale up further. Dr. Ramatlapeng's call for assistance is a powerful rebuke to those who call for AIDS de-investment. We should also consider what is insufficiently dealt with at this conference. Vuyiseka Dubula and Matt Kavanagh have led the call at this conference, criticizing its lack of TB content. I'm glad to say that at this morning's excellent plenary, that was addressed to some extent. In Africa, the region with the largest HIV epidemic, AIDS-related deaths are massive due to TB. TB has also exposed the serious shortcomings of our health systems, most evident in the growth of drug-resistant TB, particularly in South Africa. Lack of political will and investment means we have low cure rates, suboptimal drugs and diagnostics, and no progress towards implementing our Sanazai preventative therapy. Activists at this conference, particularly in high TB regions such as Southern Africa, must take Vuyiseka and Matt's message home and campaign for an effective response to TB. Scientists, academic institutions, pharmaceutical companies, and donors at this conference also have a duty to step up their investment and research in TB. I want to thank the team of rapporteurs who worked with me, Nithya, Richard, Rebecca, Gavin, Manju, Mandeep, Edward, and a special thanks to Janelle for looking after us, and Emily and the staff of volunteers who assisted the rapporteurs. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. It has been a long and exciting week. Each morning, noon, and night filled with a vast array of abstract-driven, non-abstract-driven, special sessions, skills-building workshops, global village, satellite meetings, summits, cultural events, affiliated events, the youth program, the press conferences, the marches, the rallies, the exhibition area, the engagement tours. We are all exhausted, but no one is more exhausted than the rapporteurs and their teams who dedicated their time and energy for free to the conference. Please thank them. Thank you. Now, the closing session will begin in about 10 minutes. We have a closing keynote from Professor Michelle Kazashkin, the Executive Director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and the final closing lineup of speakers. We just need to rearrange the stage, so stand up, do a little exercise, move around a little bit, but don't leave the room or somebody's going to come and steal your seat. Thank you.